Welcome back to Mentors Collective. If you're an entrepreneur and you've ever considered e-commerce as a primary business model, it can be a tough world out there. A lot of people are doing drop shipping, white labeling, and it can get pretty crowded. But the most successful e-commerce entrepreneurs that I've ever met that I know design and manufacture their own innovative products. So if this is something that sounds appealing to you, you're going to want to listen up. On this episode, I brought to you a guest who did the exact thing that I'm talking about. He designed and manufactured a pretty revolutionary wallet, and he's going to be sharing some of his insights into how he built this company, designed the product, set up manufacturing, set up supply chain, and built partnerships with names like Lionel Messi, you heard of him, the soccer legend, and Andrew Schultz, the hilarious, famous comedian. He's been Forbes 30 Under 30, and we are honored to have him today. Olivier Mama, welcome to the show, my brother.
Thanks so much, Jay. Appreciate it. Excited to chat today.
Excited to chat with you. You've had a lot of success. I've got a lot to learn from you. The audience has a lot to learn from you. I'd love to start hearing a little bit about your story, my friend. You look like a really young guy if you're watching this on video. He's tuning in from Amsterdam. How old are you? When did you start this company? What's your story like? Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Honestly, the painful part is I just turned 30 a few weeks back, and I feel 30. it hit me pretty hard. But I was born in Amsterdam, but I was raised abroad. So we moved around every 5 years. I spent most of my youth in Tokyo, actually in Japan, but moved to Italy, Barcelona, the US, Hong Kong. So most of my youth, I was hopping from city to city. And after this, I would say international youth, we moved back to the Netherlands and I started studying in Rotterdam, studied business. But I still kind of felt like I needed to leave and get out of Holland. It just felt very small to me. So I went to the US and I did a Fulbright scholarship there. And when I moved there, there was only one other Dutch guy at that university. And we instantly kind of grew close. And this guy was called Rick. And at that point, I didn't know that he would become my future co-founder at Exer. So we both moved back to the Netherlands to continue our studies. And we were both studying business. And at some point when I, in my second year, moved to Hong Kong for an internship, I called up Rick and I was like, you know, people are actually in Hong Kong, they're paying with their phones already. How come in Europe, people are still carrying fat bifold wallets? Like, what's going on? So we started brainstorming and we thought, okay, why don't we make the next generation smart wallet, the step after the bifold wallet? And that's the beginning of our journey as entrepreneurs together. And in that process, we also linked up with Richard, the third co-founder, who was already an IT legend. So he helped us build everything up. But yeah, those are the base, the startings of the company.
Very cool. What is a Fulbright scholarship? What was that? And how was your experience in business school? And do you think it helped you with your entrepreneurial journey? I always wonder that myself. I studied medicine, went to medical school, and it wasn't until that gap year that I even learned how to do business. So I always wonder what life would have been like if I went to, you know, like a Harvard business school, something like that, where I could make those connections, learn some fundamentals. Tell me about your education in the business world and how it moved you into this role.
I would say the Fulbright scholarship was my first step into becoming an adult. I was 17 when I started, and I had always lived, you know, at home with my parents, and this was my first step into becoming completely independent and moving to a different country by myself. You know, I was already used to moving around, but doing it completely alone is a different ball game. And so we entered the US, we started this Fulbright scholarship. It's pretty much a scholarship you apply to by doing multiple interviews, writing a letter of motivation, and going through different hoops to kind of be one of the few that's selected. And once you get accepted, you get to choose between different universities. I ended up in Pittsburgh because I found a school that really kind of checked all the boxes for me. And it was a business school as well. And when I went there, that's when I first kind of got into the whole business arena. So I never really knew much about business. I just knew that my dad was in business, but I didn't know much about management or entrepreneurship. And I followed a few courses, enjoyed it, but honestly, I was young, didn't know much. And I was also just trying to experience the American university lifestyle. But when I moved back to Rotterdam, I started studying at Erasmus University and really for the first time felt that, you know, okay, this is a serious study. Like it was actually super, super challenging and also fun to follow those courses. But what I realized after that is, okay, university is fun, but I don't feel like I'm learning anything about building a business. Like I don't feel like I'm learning actual business tactics. And that's when I decided I wanted to do an internship abroad and realized, okay, this is where like when once you're on the work floor, that's when you start learning stuff. So if I look back, I don't feel like my studies necessarily had much to do with me starting Exter. I feel like the actual internship experience was way more valuable to me.
Yeah, the hands-on application that you get actually out there doing it, I can't imagine you getting nearly that value in a classroom. Now, let me ask you, in terms of entrepreneurship, I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs on this show. Most of them fail and fail and fail, and then they finally find something that works. Did you have any of those failures leading up to this success that you've built? Or were you just kind of, you found your co-founders, you got your funding, and it just worked? Tell me a little bit about that process.
Definitely. So the first venture I started was right before I left to Hong Kong. I was already brainstorming stuff together with Rick, and we joined this incubator where we thought, okay, I'd lived in so many different countries, and I knew that there was delicacies in each country. Rick grew up in South Africa, or he had family there, so he knew that there was delicacies there that would work really well in the Netherlands. And we thought, why don't we try to find a system where we can bring delicacies from certain countries to others and really push them into all different retail channels there. And we called it Deli Scout. So we were just scouting delicacies, starting with fried Dutch food and bringing it to the US. We knew how much the US people loved fried food. We experienced that during university. So we brought the Dutch croquette to Pittsburgh and just started like distributing it over there. So we just started having people taste it on campus. We filmed everything. We did some, you know, some focus groups and realized people loved it. But we were both 21 years old. We had no funds to really start this supply chain. And after a year of trying that, we pretty quickly already failed at being able to bring frozen foods into the US, you know, making it FDA approved. And that whole system was way over our heads. We didn't have enough experience there. So yeah, that was our first experience. And 1 year of working quite hard and then realizing we didn't have the money to do it was quite a slap in the face. But it also brought us to where we are today, I think.
And where did you get the funding for this company as a young guy? Obviously, designing your own product, manufacturing your own product isn't cheap to start. Did you have help? Did you take out a loan? What was that process like?
For Exter, you're talking about, right? Or for the first company?
For Exter, yeah, Exter. The current company.
Cool. So we actually did a Kickstarter campaign. I realized I don't even think I explained what we were selling at the time, but our very first product was a trackable wallet, the next generation wallet, which is a super slim wallet with a button that clicks out your cards so you can easily access your cards, but it's also trackable with your phone. So pretty much changing the way you carry your everyday items. And we realized, okay, we don't have the funds to set up like a web shop and produce this ahead of time. What are alternative routes? We were both Kickstarter fans. So we decided, okay, let's do some market research. Are there other brands doing this on Kickstarter? Are there any wallets that are successful? And we realized that this was quite a successful niche on this platform. So we decided to start building this campaign. It took about a year to design and to create the video. And it was all very duct tape solution DIY. And after a year of just hacking away at this campaign, we turned the campaign on. And within 24 hours, we were funded. And within 45 days, we raised 350K, which was, for us, was just unimaginable. The amount of funding we brought. And we didn't even have a factory at that time and no business experience.
why do you think your Kickstarter campaign was so successful? That's massively successful for like a first try. What was the key to raising all of that money?
So there's definitely a few growth hacks that helped. I would say the if we're looking at the bigger tactics, we would dissect all the biggest Kickstarter campaigns that were out there. So all the $1 million campaigns. And we found some trends that all of them had in common. There's just a few tricks that all of them always copied from each other that we realized, okay, we need to follow this guidebook of what all the best ones are doing, and then we'll be successful in some kind of way. But we never expected it to be, you know, explode this much. But it's all about the structure of your campaign. There's like a recipe of how you design your video. It's all about simplicity in the rewards where people buy and choose the products, keeping that as simple as possible. Using a bunch of growth hacks throughout the campaign that convince people that it's is a trustworthy campaign to back. And it's all about playing around with the algorithm. So you want to pretty much get to your funding level or to your goal within 24 hours. That's the goal, because that pushes you onto the popular page on Kickstarter. And obviously there's a lot of details to this, but the amount of people that back you multiplied by the amount of engagement in your comments, multiplied by the amount of video views you get on your campaign, all those little metrics, they count to how high your campaign is pushed on the popular page. And that's where all the traffic is at. So pretty much you want to get as high up on the popular page as you can to get as many eyeballs on your campaign.
I'm sure we could probably spend an entire episode talking about Kickstarter hacks, and people would probably enjoy it a lot. Any other growth hacks that you can mention? I know that you just mentioned some social proof on the page. Maybe just a few more tips that people can think about if they're launching a Kickstarter campaign that they could think about including in their page, like keeping the rewards and benefits really simple, I think is a great one. Reaching your goal within 24 hours, that's another gem. So thank you for sharing that. If you can mention a couple others, I think people would really appreciate it. Sounds like you've got some serious knowledge there.
Yeah, so we literally just reached out to the best campaigns out there and asked them if they were down for a quick video call to ask them questions and just ask for tips. And that's the nice thing about the Kickstarter community is everyone is really helping each other. It doesn't feel like a competitive environment. A few other tips that we found was cross promotions with other campaigns. So everyone on Kickstarter is trying to help each other push their campaigns to be as successful as possible. So what we did is we reached out to like the campaigns that had the largest amount of backers, so like 5K plus backers. And we asked if they were down for a cross promotion in their weekly update. And on Kickstarter, you give a weekly update to your backers. So at the bottom of your update, you can cross promote other brands. And so what we did is per update, we had five different brands at the bottom that we said, these are other campaigns that we like, and we would be included in theirs as well. So it's pretty much free referrals from other campaigns with like-minded backers that are already on the platform. So there's less, you know, less obstacles to purchase. Obviously, this goes without saying, but a pre-campaign is crucial to the success. So gathering a list of a few thousand people that are, you know, leads that are interested in your campaign or in your type of product. You can do this through ads. You can do this through social media. But building a pre-list to push the first 24 hours of your campaign to be successful, that's one of the most crucial parts of building a big campaign, I would say. And on top of that, there's a lot of platforms that help you reach other Kickstarter backers, like BackerKit, LaunchBoom. There's these like specific Kickstarter platforms where for quite a decent fee, you can get promoted to a bunch of Kickstarter users.
Very cool. How much money in total did you raise during that Kickstarter campaign, that initial fundraise? You said you hit like 350K in the first 24 hours. Did you keep it running? Did that tally keep going up? What was the total amount?
Yeah, so that was the crazy part. We didn't really have the means or the funding to build a web shop before that. So we decided to keep the campaign running on Indiegogo as an in-demand campaign. And that whole first year, we ran the campaign on Indiegogo. We raised over $1 million in our first year of revenue, and it was super profitable. It was like 20% EBITDA.
That's amazing. So now you've got $1 million and you've obviously got the resources to go design something, start building something, start selling something. What was that process like? What were your next steps? Did you already have a product designed, or at this point, was it time to go work with an engineer or maybe try and engineer it yourself? Tell me about what your next steps were.
So we had a very vague, we had a design on paper, but it wasn't an industrial design. It wasn't like an engineered design that we could bring to a factory, and it wasn't ready to go for mass production. So we took the funds, and we just instantly flew to China, and we had appointments with 6 different factories, and they were all around the same cities. So we literally just flew to China and lived there for about 2 months, and just went from factory to factory, looking at their expertise, looking at which other brands they were working with. And we did have some advisors in our network that helped us out before we left to really just make sure that we didn't make the dumb mistakes that they made back in their day. And one of the first tips that we really held close was, it's in the early stages, you're going to be very, it's very easy to choose a more affordable factory because you don't have the funds, right? But long-term, if you choose a factory that's going to take a bit more of your margins, but does have the proof that they work with bigger brands and does use sustainable materials and does have connections with cleaner supply chains rather than sketchy ones, that's going to save you, a huge chunk in the future. So we definitely canceled a lot of the smaller factories that were more affordable to choose for well-established ones that were definitely more expensive, but also more trustworthy. And so we spent that whole month in China, pretty much living in the factories, and ended up picking one. And even that, this was definitely one of the more premium factories. Even that was a complete disaster. If you look at what we wanted and what we got in terms of first products. So just day in, day out, sitting there tinkering, playing around with the products and making sure that production would start on time. And as you know, most campaigns on Kickstarter are delayed. So that happened with us as well, but the delay was quite decent. It wasn't that bad. It was like a 1 month delay.
And you started off with just a single product, the smart wallet. Since then, I see that you've branched out quite a bit from there. How was the success with that wallet? And this was years ago. What made you decide to start producing other products? Did you do them all with the same factory? Did you Kickstarter for them, or did you just use your existing customer base to launch those new products? Tell me a little bit about expanding out from that product.
We weren't that quick with branching out, and that's one of the things I regret most. But I think simplicity may have also really helped us grow the company. So we spent the first 2 years with 2 models of wallets in 4 colors and just pushing those as hard as we could. Only I think year 3 or 4 is when we started building or expanding to other categories to make sure that we had upsellable products. We really wanted to cross sell our customer list, key cases. We wanted to cross sell them other models of wallets, and later on laptop sleeves and phone cases. I still think that this expansion to other categories, it helped for the brand to build a brand, and it helped a little bit in increasing the AOV, but it also took focus away from the core collection. And that's one of the things I've really learned over the years, is that focus is so key. And it's almost better to just build the base of your company with a super simple catalog of products and just super focused on that and being the best at just that, rather than expanding too quickly and losing focus of what's bringing in most of the revenue. And I would say now recently, in over the past year, is the first time that we're really ready to expand to other categories and also have a team big enough to invest in marketing for each of these categories. So we just recently expanded to backpacks this year and are taking the travel gear direction. So we're going to be releasing a lot more bigger products, everything that has to do with travel, over the next year. And we have some really sick designs that are ready to go. So now that the team is big enough to handle this marketing wise, we're ready to expand beyond wallets in a more serious way.
I love that. And I love the travel gear direction. I said you've got a team of around 45. I'd love to talk a little bit about some of your first hires, some of the most important hires when it comes to building an e-commerce company. Who are those people? Who are those key players?
So it really went in phases for us. I remember the first 2 years, the biggest pain point at Exter was supply chain and operations. We just weren't able to get that nailed down, and we weren't able to keep our products in stock. That was the biggest issue. So we were really bad at forecasting. We were bad at splitting stock between warehouses, and we were too ambitious in wanting to deliver worldwide from the very beginning. So we had like 6 warehouses all over the world, and we wanted to do Asia, we wanted to do Europe, the US, even though, you know, 80% of our revenue was in the US. And that comes back to the focus lesson that we learned is, if we just scrap all of the stuff that doesn't make an impact and focus on the US, you know, that's going to take us 10 steps further. So the first big hire was head of operations. That helped us streamline, you know, both operations of shipping, but also customer service and making sure that the back end of the company was ready to go. And then the second, I would say, that made most impact was head of acquisition or head of performance marketing, taking that in-house, because that's where you're saving a lot of money in agency fees and you have a lot more control and a lot more time in the accounts to grow your marketing channels. So back end first, and after that, performance marketing.
Yeah, that's helpful. I can imagine all of the supply chain stuff is tough. We sell a couple supplements on Amazon primarily, and it is a nightmare just to keep everything in stock and keep it moving in the right direction. Now, with that being said, talk to me about some of your sales channels. Do you stick to just website sales, keep it all in your ecosystem, or do you leverage some of these other sites like Amazon on bigger retailers, maybe getting your products in retail stores? Where do you sell your product? What have you found effective? What have you tried?
So it's funny because this really went in waves as well. We were very ambitious in expanding to different channels at the very beginning, but very quickly learned that that was our downfall as well, and caused so much clutter in the back end that we weren't even growing with these new channels. It was just bringing us more headache. At first, we had our web shop. Then we opened Amazon, and we opened about 50 different retailers in the US, both online and offline. But we just realized that these retailers alone were taking up more time than they were bringing in terms of revenue and branding. So when COVID came, this was, you know, the perfect moment to just scrap all of retail and take a break for 2 years and focus 100% on online, because this is also exactly when the e-com boost came and most e-commerce companies grew exponentially during COVID. So these were some of our best years, and we couldn't have been happier with the choice to scrap retail. Right now, our biggest channels are our own webshop and Amazon. Amazon has become an incremental channel over the years. It used to be kind of like a supporting channel to our webshop, but we're now realizing that Amazon is also bringing in a lot of incremental revenue that we wouldn't even convert on our own website. And we're now slowly moving back into retail, both online and offline, and third-party channels.
Cool, but mostly your website and mostly Amazon. Very good. Now, what about what do you do for marketing? Seems like your branding is awesome, really clean, minimalistic. Do you do a lot of paid ads to your website? Do you do a lot of Amazon SEO, Amazon search ads? Tell me a little bit about what brings in the most revenue for you guys.
So performance marketing is definitely the number one. It has been over the past 6 years. I would say Meta and Google.
What is performance marketing?
That's social ads. So both like ads on Google, ads on Meta, ads on TikTok, Pinterest, Reddit, all those channels. We're doing every single channel you can imagine at the moment. So we split it up into different buckets. We have our main performers, which are Meta and Google. Then we have the rough diamonds, which is pretty much like channels that could have a huge uplift, but have not shown steady performance. So TikTok is one of those. Twitter is one of those. And then we have like just smaller support channels like native advertising or in email advertising in like bigger newsletters. And we try to bring all of the smaller channels into the bigger bucket by testing, making sure that we work with experts in the field that help us get some steady performance in these channels. But we also realize that some channels just don't work year round. Like connected television is a great example. We've done a lot of TV ads and they work super well in like the high times, like Black Friday and Father's Day, but they don't really perform in summer. Right. And you can keep spending, but it's also a waste of budget. You could be putting that budget into other channels. So yeah, when it comes to online marketing, we're really pushing all of these performance channels. And we also now recently started investing a lot in branding. So working with bigger ambassadors, content creators, and working on product collaborations with other brands.
All right. So you've got a partnership with one of the biggest soccer legends of all time, arguably the biggest soccer legend of all time, Messi. How did you guys pull that one off? That sounds like it costs millions of dollars. So as a startup, you know, that sounds out of reach. Talk to me about the details of that partnership. How'd you guys acquire Messi?
Yeah, so any normal partnership with Messi would cost millions of dollars. If you reach out directly to his agent for a post on his Instagram account, you'd pay about $1.5 million USD. And that's not something we have laying around. So we decided to figure out if there was a back door somewhere. And we knew we wanted to work with one of the biggest celebrities in the world, whether it was Messi or maybe some kind of DJ of artist or anything else. But Messi was at that time the most hyped celebrity in the world. He was playing the World Cup, or he was going to play the World Cup. And so we decided to reach out to the Messi store. Messi store is a merchandising company, which owned by, or which partners up with Messi to sell his clothes. So t-shirts, sweaters, anything that has his name on it. And we reached out to them because we saw that they had clothes on their website, but they didn't have any wallets. And maybe we thought, okay, we don't have to go through the traditional route for this. Or maybe we can work with the web shop and see if they're down to work with us and also shoot content with Messi. So we reached out, had a great call, had a click, and they were totally down to add this smart wallet to their collection, which for us was super exciting because this web shop was linked to directly from Messi's Instagram, which is the most followed Instagram account on the platform. And so we reached out, we said, okay, let's design a custom wallet. Let's do something that he likes, like a color that he likes. And this process took about a year. And this year was leading up to the World Cup. And so we knew, okay, around the World Cup is definitely a great time to launch. So hurried, worked together with them to design the final product and actually went to Paris to do the shoot. And we really wanted Messi to hold this product, obviously, to really empower the whole campaign. And we ended up getting him on set and getting him with our product in his hand for the photos and for the videos. And he ended up posting it on his Instagram channel, which was the end goal for us. So one of the coolest collabs we could have ever done. Super proud of this, how this turned out. And the timing couldn't have been better because he became the World Cup champion in that same month.
Yeah, really incredible. So a really creative way to get in with one of the biggest A-list celebrities and athletic legends of all time. So I guess the note and the takeaway from there is you'd be surprised who you have access to if you can get creative and think outside of the box. So very, very cool. What about Andrew Schultz? Tell me a little bit about that collaboration. That's another A-list, maybe B-lister, but still probably millions of dollars if you were to pay him to start posting on his podcast and his Instagram account. How'd you guys lock in Andrew Schultz?
So Andrew Schultz was a little different. We were obviously big fans of his comedy, and the Dutch are very direct. We love direct humor, and he's one of the few guys that really pushed the limits of direct humor, and really he dares to say stuff that other people don't dare to. And we'd been following him around for a long time, and we saw that he launched his first podcast, Flagrant. And very early on in the Flagrant days, we were on top of it. We were listening to his podcast and realized maybe there's a chance that they're down to work with us or have us as a sponsor. And we literally just reached out to them and said, guys, we're big fans. We'd love to hop on a call. Let's see if we can make something work. And the team over there is super nice. They're very, they're not like most partnerships team. Teams. They're not that money minded. They really just work with partners that they like. So we sent them over a bunch of products and they loved the wallets. They're like, okay, this is really cool stuff. Let's find a way to work together. So we started sponsoring their podcasts. Not allowed to disclose how much, but you know, we had a good deal and it was fair for both teams. Like it's a mutually beneficial deal. And now that we've been working with them for so long, we're also exploring other collaborations, so potential product collabs, and we see this as a long-term partnership, and we're proud to be affiliated with them.
Yeah, any affiliation is so powerful. How do you guys use those in your marketing? Do you say, you know, proud partner of Messi, official wallet of Andrew Schultz? In what ways do you leverage those massive names?
We do it to the point where it's allowed. So Messi was a temporary contract, so we're not allowed to use it in our ads anymore. But during that period, we definitely pushed it a lot, and we saw a huge uptake in performance. Same with Andrew Schultz. So he really is protective about his image. We can't just randomly use his video content in our ads, which we respect, right? So we try to just be very transparent with them in the way we use their content, and we have a very open communication line with them. So whether we use it in email marketing or ads, we just need to be respectful of the rules.
Fair, and I expect them to be protective about using that. So that's why I was curious how these A-listers really treat it and what kind of limitations they put on you guys. But very cool partnerships. And you mentioned that you recently met Andrew. It's awesome. I'm a big fan. He's a great dude. So Olivier, I'd love to talk a little bit about some of your, I guess, secrets to success that you would say that you found over the years. You recently made it to Forbes 30 under 30. Was one of my dreams. It didn't come true. I just turned 32. So maybe 40 under 40 is down the road.
Yeah,
what do you think got you there? You know, what are your superpowers as an entrepreneur?
I would say for me, I was always a creative kid. As a kid, I wanted to become an architect. I really wanted to use my drawing skills and my creative mind to build something that I believed in. And from the very beginning, my power at Exter was selling stuff, like showing what the benefits of the products were and showing people by storytelling and building a brand from the ground up. And I think early on, just the very early days, thinking out how this product was positioned in the market and what the video would look like to sell it on Kickstarter, I think was definitely a core part of why Exter exists today. And so I would say the creativity behind that, being able to put myself in the customer's shoes and think of how to convey this message to them that it becomes attractive to them was the first one. Second, I would say for me personally, my international background and open, like my open-minded vision to other cultures has really helped us build the company as well. Like our whole team is extremely international. We have, I think we have over 13 nationalities here at Exter, and that has brought us a lot of value. It has brought us a lot of skills from different countries, but also new perspectives on marketing and new perspectives on how to build a team, which has really helped us get where we are today. And yeah, overall, I just like working really hard. Like I spend most of my days at the office until 9 p.m. Grinding away because I just enjoy what I do. And I think in the end, it's really about having fun while you're doing it, because if you're going to be doing stuff that drains your energy, that's felt by the rest of the team, right? People need to see that you're doing your craft and you love doing it.
I agree. You have to love building. I think all of the successful, very successful entrepreneurs that I've talked about have that in common. They love the process of building. Now, for a lot of the under 30 entrepreneurs that I have listening to this, which is most, how did you get Forbes 30 under 30? That's a pretty common dream, common goal that a lot of entrepreneurs share. What was the process like? What was the application like? And what can people work on to be considered for that award?
I think it's all about networking. It's all about reaching out to the right people and showing that you're ambitious. I was 27 at the time when I started thinking about this, and I knew I had 3 years to make it happen. So first step I took was I looked at my own network. Who do I know that's either Forbes under 30 or has friends or siblings that are? And I found a few people that were either like the sister of someone who was Forbes 30 under 30 or someone who had a connection in common with one of those people. And I just started nurturing those relationships. So I reached out. I said, hey, you want to hop on a chat and share some knowledge, talk about business, and literally nurtured those relationships for 2 years. Had calls, met up for coffee, and really just kind of got close, but also provided value, you know, showed them what we were doing and helped them out in their business. And some of these people became close friends, and some of them I just stayed in touch with purely for business. But they helped me get an introduction, get a referral at Forbes. And it's all about getting into the big pile of applications, right? So that's step one. And as soon as people have referred you to get onto that pile of applications, then it's all in your own hands of writing a beautiful motivation letter and rocking the call that you get when they randomly call you to kind of interview you. So the motivation, I just spent, it felt like a thesis to me. I really just spent so much time and energy in writing and pouring my heart out on paper to tell them, you know, what I stand for, the business that we've built, and why I would be a perfect candidate. And then you get a call and they ask you a bunch of questions. And I believe I was in Madrid at the time. It was like 9 p.m. I was at a restaurant, like having drinks, and I got that call and I just instantly went into focus mode and spent like 30 minutes on the phone talking about all the stuff that they were asking me. And I guess the first step is important, like nurturing relationships and finding people. But after that, it's all about just writing a great motivation letter.
Oh, super exciting. How has that changed your trajectory as an entrepreneur? Do you use it in your business and your marketing? Or is it kind of something that you forgot about after it happened?
It has brought me a huge network of people that I can now reach out to. So you're part of this Slack group with all the people that have ever joined the Forbes 30 under 30 club. So there's thousands of people in there and you can reach out to them directly, which is insane. Like, it's just a direct line to anyone. But there's also communities in all different cities. So whenever we go to LA, we reach out to people at Forbes 30 under 30 and then they take us out, or we join events. We've been to events in different cities like Tel Aviv a few years ago. Like, there's just some really cool events that you can join, and you're always in touch. Like, I'm in different WhatsApp groups where you can just reach out, and if you have a question about management or coaching, there's always people that can help out.
So for those looking to get Forbes 30 under 30, I guess find people who have already done it and start building your network with those people. Spend some time, invest the time into those relationships, and that's a good first step. So great tip there. Okay, Olivier, final tips for entrepreneurs who are not quite there yet. They're truly trying to build something. They're trying to get successful. What are some of the ahas that you've had that you can share with others that might move them forward towards their goal?
There's definitely a lot. We made all the mistakes you could possibly make, especially at the beginning. The biggest one that really made impact from the beginning was benchmarking. Like, that's one of the things that we've done from day one, because when you're a 20-year-old student without any funding or business experience, what's the best way to set something up without reinventing the wheel? It's looking at the top, in my case, D2C brands out there, and just analyzing everything they do, signing up to their newsletters, checking their status changes on their website, and just going through all of their web pages and landing pages and analyzing how they sell their products, and doing this with, you know, 20 different top performing Shopify web shops. There's always trends. There's always things that they all do the same. It's because it works. And this started for us on Kickstarter, but this also trickled over the years into all these different web shops that we started using as inspiration, because obviously you can try to invent it yourself, but if you look at how successful other brands have become doing it, that's where you learn quickest. So benchmark is number one. Then I would say the second is team building has been both our weakness, but also more recently our strength. At first, we wanted to do everything ourselves. We felt, you know, like superheroes because we had this successful Kickstarter campaign, but realized very quickly that without building a team of people that are smarter than us, we weren't going to get into the big leagues. So we very quickly started working with recruiters to build a team and really try to build a culture where people became friends at the office and would chill during and outside of office hours. And we realized, okay, we now have the base. You know, we have four managing partners that all have their own little corner. We have the marketing guy, which is me, the product guy, which is Rick, IT, Richard, and Tom on finance. Now we need a whole army of people who are going to help us execute this. And I would say building this team has taught me so much about being a leader and about building a successful company. But it's also what has helped us get where we are today. So team building, huge. Like, this is another, it would be a separate podcast if we would dive into the details of that. But I think that's so important to not do everything yourself and make sure you invest time into building your team.
Yeah, all great advice. I appreciate you sharing all of that. So for those listening that really liked what you had to say, is there any place where we can connect with you? And is there anything that you're working on right now that we can support and help you move forward?
Definitely. You can find me on LinkedIn with my name, Oliver Moma. It's a European name, so we might have to write it out. And currently we are working on expanding
Mama,
our...
So sorry.
No worries, Moma. We're working on expanding our travel collection. So we just launched our first backpack, the Grid Backpack. I'd love for everyone to check it out. We're super proud of the results and the reviews are incredible. So this is our step into the travel industry, and there's more bags and other big products to come. So check it out and let us know what you think.
Well, appreciate that. The backpack looks super slick. I've got it right here pulled up. So we'll link that down in the show notes. And if you want to get a backpack over to me, I'll do everything I can to promote this thing as well.
Got you.
And Oliver, this is Olivier. It was a blast having you on the show today. I love what you built. I love talking to entrepreneurs who have really done it, designed their own products, built large, successful companies. I hope to have you in my network for quite a long time and vice versa. So thank you for coming and sharing your wisdom with me and the audience today.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you so much. Had a lot of fun.